Odessa area. It's 51 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. From the Recording Library of West Texas, I'm Michael. Coming up, here are some of the articles we'll be reading. U.S. reports new daily record of more than 4,300 COVID-19 deaths. An article that is about the state of the pandemic in America. Results are expected soon with Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine, though production lags. CDC to require all air travelers to U.S. to show negative coronavirus test. Chinese COVID-19 vaccine far less effective than initially claimed, sparking concerns. Study projects how coronavirus might someday join the mix of common childhood colds. EasyJet cabin crew of the U.K. to become COVID-19 vaccinators as U.K. rollout is fast-tracked. Reasons to be cheerful. Vaccines expert explains why he thinks U.S. can stop the spread of the virus by June. Coronavirus shutdowns have quashed nearly all other common viruses, but scientists say a rebound is coming. First, we'll take a look at the numbers from the Odessa American. Ector County numbers are not updated daily. It does give ECISD daily cases as 14 students and 8 staff. From the Midland Reporter Telegram, here's an article that includes the numbers. The city of Midland reported another 6 Midland County residents died this month because of complications with COVID-19. The city showed the deaths took place from January 6th through the 12th and involved 3 women and 3 men. Those passing away included 2 patients in their 50s, 1 in his 70s, 2 in their 80s, and a woman in her 90s. 5 were said to have underlying conditions, according to the city. All but one was being treated at Midland Memorial. The other was being treated at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. The deaths were the 10th through the 15th reported this month and brought the total during the pandemic to 200. As of Tuesday afternoon, the Department of State Health Services website showed 29 other Texas counties with 200 or more COVID-related fatalities. The Midland Health Department did report 70 total cases on Monday. That's a decrease from the 198 cases on January 4th. In fact, the health department shows 84 cases on Sunday and Monday. That's less than the 289 on January 3rd and 4th. The total number of cases inside Midland County is up to 14,502. From the Texas Tribune, more than 30,000 people in Texas have died from COVID-19. Average new cases increased by 3,536 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On January 12th, 22,110 new confirmed cases and 3,191 new probable cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 910 patients compared with a week ago. As of January 12th, 14,218 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 78 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On January 12th, 286 new deaths in Texas were reported. Here are coronavirus briefs for this Wednesday. Facing new outbreaks, China puts more than 22 million under lockdown. Japan extends a state of emergency. A South Korea church leader receives a suspended prison term after virus fallout. Elders' COVID deaths create a cultural crisis for Native Americans. The death of a Miami doctor who received a coronavirus vaccine is being investigated. Japan has banned foreign nationals from entering the country and put 7 further regions under a state of emergency. England is considering putting COVID patients in hotels as a study reveals deep trauma among ICU workers. Putin orders mass vaccination in Russia from next week. Vatican begins COVID-19 vaccinations. Now here are coronavirus short stories. U.S. reports new daily record of more than 4,300 COVID-19 deaths from CNN's Joe Sutton in Atlanta. The United States on Tuesday reported a record high number of 4,327 new COVID-19 deaths, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. The latest figures bring the nationwide death toll to 380,670. Also on Tuesday, the U.S. reported 215,805 new COVID-19 cases, according to JHU, bringing the total number of confirmed infections to 22,838,110. The totals include cases from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and other U.S. territories, as well as repatriated cases. At least 27,696,150 vaccine doses have been distributed, and at least 9,327,138 shots administered, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC said 951,774 residents of long-term care facilities have been vaccinated, with nearly 4.4 million doses sent out to the facilities, which were designated to be the first sites covered under the vaccine rollout. From the New York Times, the state of the pandemic in America. Last week's attack on the Capitol has understandably dominated the news, but we'll take a few minutes to focus on the other vital story right now, the pandemic. Below is a three-point summary of where we are, with help from colleagues covering the story and from a couple of charts. To warm you up front, the situation is not good. 1. The new variants are scary. Scientists are still learning about new versions of the coronavirus, including variants that emerged in Britain, South Africa, and Brazil. The evidence so far indicates that they are much more infectious than the Italian strain, which has been circulating here since February. Donald G. McNeil Jr., a colleague, says that's a game changer. Behavior that may once have been only moderately risky, say airplane travel, may now be more so. The variants seem to be one reason cases worldwide are spiking. 2. The mass vaccination campaign in the U.S. is off to a terrible start. The Trump administration promised that 20 million Americans would be vaccinated by January 1st. Instead, fewer than 3 million were, and only about 9 million have now had their shots. The Deep South has the country's lowest vaccination rates, but this isn't just a Republican failure. California, Virginia, and some other Democratic-run states have also been slow. And then for Texas, here's a breakout. Percentage of people given a shot, 3.1%. Doses distributed, 1,949,125. Shots given, 911,461. Shots used, 47%. Vaccinations will probably accelerate in the coming weeks, especially because President-elect Joe Biden and his team seem much more focused on the problem than President Trump has been. Goldman Sachs forecasts that about one quarter of Americans will have received their first shot by April 1st, half by June 1st, and three quarters by mid-autumn. The coming vaccination speed-up is the one good piece of news right now. 3. Things are likely to get worse before they get better. The virus is spreading so rapidly that hospitals are struggling to keep up. About 130,000 Americans are hospitalized with COVID symptoms, more than double the number 2 months ago. The strain on hospitals raises the possibility that many people will not receive the best available treatments. Los Angeles has recently had to ration oxygen, and Esteban Trejo, an executive at a company in El Paso that provides oxygen to temporary hospitals, told Kaiser Health News, "It's been nuts, absolutely nuts." The recent data on cases and deaths is noisy because diagnoses artificially slowed during the holidays, says Mitch Smith, a Times reporter who follows the numbers. Still, deaths have already hit a record this week, more than 3,000 a day on average, and the recent explosion of cases suggests they may be heading to above 3,500 and possibly to 4,000. The bottom line, Biden will be taking office next week during the nadir of the coronavirus crisis. His administration will need to both accelerate vaccine distribution and persuade more people to change their behavior. And the second goal is even more urgent than the first. Unless Americans start wearing masks more often and spending less time together in cramped spaces, many more people are going to die. From the New York Times, results are expected soon with Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine, though production lags. Johnson & Johnson expects to release critical results from its coronavirus vaccine trial in as little as 2 weeks, but probably won't be able to provide as many doses this spring as it promised the federal government because of manufacturing delays. If the vaccine can strongly protect people, as some outside scientists expect, it will offer big advantages over the two vaccines authorized in the United States now. Unlike those which require two doses, Johnson & Johnson's could need just one, greatly simplifying logistics for local health departments and clinics struggling to get shots in arms. Its vaccine can also stay stable in a refrigerator for months, whereas the others have to be frozen. But the encouraging prospect of a third effective vaccine is tempered by the apparent lags in the company's production. In the company's $1 billion contract signed with the federal government in August, Johnson & Johnson pledged to have 12 million doses ready by the end of February, ramping up to a total of 100 million doses by the end of June. Federal officials have been told that the company has fallen as much as 2 months behind the original production schedule and won't catch up until the end of April, when it was supposed to have delivered more than 60 million doses, according to two people familiar with the situation who were not authorized to discuss it publicly. Dr. Paul Stoffels, Johnson & Johnson's chief scientific officer, said he expected to see clinical trial data showing whether the company's vaccine is safe and effective in late January or early February. He declined to provide details about the company's production capacity. CDC to require all air travelers to U.S. to show negative coronavirus test. From CNN's Maggie Fox. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said Tuesday it will require a negative COVID-19 test from all air passengers entering the United States, a move it says may help slow the spread of the coronavirus. Air passengers will be required to get a viral test within 3 days before their flight to the U.S. departs, and to provide written documentation of their lab results or documentation of having recovered from COVID-19, the agency said in a statement to CNN. CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield is expected to sign the order on Tuesday, and it will go into effect January 26th. Chinese COVID-19 vaccine is far less effective than initially claimed, sparking concerns. From CNN's Nectar Gon, Tatiana Arias, and Yong Jiang. A leading Chinese COVID-19 vaccine developed by Sinovac Biotech was just 50.38% effective in late-stage trials in Brazil, significantly lower than earlier results showed, according to a statement published by the government of Sao Paulo Tuesday. While the number just exceeds the threshold required for regulatory approval, it falls far below the 78% previously announced, raising questions as to the veracity of the data and fueling skepticism over the apparent lack of transparency regarding Chinese vaccines. Study projects how coronavirus might someday join the mix of common childhood colds. From CNN Health's Maggie Fox. Since the start of the pandemic, scientists have mused that the novel coronavirus might eventually go the way of other coronaviruses that affect people and join the mix of viruses that cause the common cold. A study published Tuesday takes a look at how that might happen and how mass vaccination might affect that natural cycle. This transition may take anywhere from a few years to a few decades, depending on how fast the pathogen spreads. Jeannie Levine, a researcher from Emory University, and colleagues reported in the journal Science. The current pandemic is likely as deadly as it is because it's a new virus affecting people who have no immunity to it. It's worse in older adults because their bodies aren't used to fighting off new viruses in the same way children's bodies are, the researcher said. But it's similar to four other coronaviruses that cause symptoms no worse than the common cold in most people. Once it has been circulating for a while, the current coronavirus may do the same, they said. Studies of the body's immune response indicate that immunity that can completely block infection wanes rapidly, they wrote. But people would have residual immunity that it protects against severe disease. If the virus starts to circulate freely everywhere, it would become endemic or permanently entrenched in the population. Once the endemic phase is reached and primary exposure is in childhood, COV2 may be no more virulent than the common cold, Levine and colleagues hypothesized. EasyJet cabin crew to become COVID-19 vaccinators as UK rollout is fast-tracked. From CNN's Lauren Kent and Lindsay Isaac in London. Cabin crew members and pilots for the British discount airline EasyJet will be trained to administer COVID-19 vaccines, the company said Wednesday. EasyJet said it expects hundreds of its employees to volunteer for fast-tracked training to become vaccinators at immunization centers across the country. EasyJet, like other airlines, has been operating on a reduced schedule since the beginning of the pandemic, with many employees receiving government support. Over 3,000 crew are first aid trained. And this from the Washington Post today. Coronavirus shutdowns have quashed nearly all other common viruses, but scientists say a rebound is coming. By Dan Hurley, published January 12th. Veteran virus trackers say they are chronicling something never before seen, the suppression of virtually every common respiratory and gastrointestinal virus besides the novel coronavirus. They theorize that this is largely due to global shutdowns, mask wearing, and a host of other health protocols aimed at stemming the spread of the coronavirus. These other viruses, including influenza A, influenza B, parian influenza, norovirus, respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, human metapneumovirus, all appear to be circulating at or near levels lower than ever previously measured. The same is true for the respiratory bacteria that causes pertussis, better known as whooping cough, and pneumonia. It's crazy, said Lynette Brammer, who leads the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Domestic Influenza Surveillance Team. This is my 30th flu season. I would never have expected to see flu activity this low. In 2019, during the third week of December, before the coronavirus struck the United States, the CDC's network of clinical labs reported that 16.2% of the 29,578 samples tested were positive for influenza A. During the same week in 2020, the rate was 0.3%. An online map of flu activity maintained by the CDC offers striking visual evidence of the effect. In 2020, for the week ending December 19th, the map of the United States is a sea of green, showing minimal levels in every state. For the corresponding week in 2019, most states were red, high, or deep blue, very high. Another virus, enterovirus D68, linked to a polio-like paralysis seen mostly in children, has likewise been greatly reduced. As recently as August, CDC officials warned doctors and parents to be on the lookout for cases of the polio-like condition, known as acute flaccid myelitis. Outbreaks of the condition have peaked in a peculiar every other year cycle for 6 years, with 120 cases across the United States in 2014, 153 in 2016, and 240 in 2018. But in 2020, the CDC confirmed just 29 cases. We haven't had any specimen positive for enterovirus D68 at our site in Colorado since July, and my colleagues around the country also saw very little, said Kevin Messiker, a pediatric infectious disease physician at Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora. We also have not seen significant influenza or RSV in our wards in Colorado. All the most common childhood infections that land children in the hospital, influenza, croup, bronchiolitis, we are not seeing. As welcome as the absence of these other viruses is during a pandemic, epidemiologists say they see a potentially dangerous consequence after coronavirus cases eventually decline, a rebound that could be frightfully large given the relaxation of social distancing and lowered immunity to other pathogens. The best analogy is to a forest fire, said Brian Grenfell, an epidemiologist and population biologist at Princeton. For the fire to spread, it needs to have unburned wood. For epidemics to spread, they require people who haven't previously been infected. So if people don't get infected this year by these viruses, they likely will at some point later on. The possibility of a rebound is not merely theoretical. It appears to be happening already in Australia. Official reports showed historically low levels of flu-like illness among children and adults beginning in May, usually the start of the flu season in that hemisphere. The sharp decline in cases came as the country imposed strict shutdown measures. But in the last few months, after the coronavirus was virtually obliterated and the country ended those restrictions, the number of flu cases among children aged 5 and younger began to soar, rising sixfold by December, when such cases are usually at their lowest. That's an important cautionary tale for us, Messiker said. Just because we get through the winter and don't see much RSV or influenza doesn't mean we'll be out of the woods. A breathtaking picture of the extent of the collapse of viral and bacterial infections can be seen in a single chart created and maintained by BioFire, a company that provides diagnostic tests for viral and bacterial infections to over 2,500 U.S. healthcare providers. The chart shows positivity rates for 13 respiratory viruses and bacteria during the past 2 years. A year ago at this time, nearly 60% of samples taken from patients with flu-like symptoms came back positive for one of the pathogens. But beginning in March of this year, when the coronavirus prompted shutdowns and school closings, the percent of samples positive for any other pathogen took a Grand Canyon-worthy plunge, bottoming out in May at just 6%. Even now, at the time of the year when respiratory infections typically begin to peak, just 18% of samples are positive for any respiratory virus or bacteria. Individual charts maintained by the CDC show similarly stark declines in national rates of infection for RSV, norovirus, metapneumovirus, and parainfluenza, as well as other types of coronaviruses. The question is, of course, is why SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, continues to spread like wildfire when so many other viruses have been crushed. The primary answer, epidemiologists say, goes back to that wildfire metaphor. Nobody on Earth had been exposed to SARS-CoV-2 before its emergence last year in China, so we were all fully susceptible. Similarly, the indigenous populations of North and South America were devastated when Europeans brought with them not just smallpox, but also chickenpox, cholera, influenza, measles, and other pathogens to which they had never been exposed. Viruses that have circulated for years, by contrast, are endemic, or always present at a base level. Because many of us have been previously exposed and therefore have developed immunity to them, social distancing can more easily cut the chain of transmission. A little bit of social distancing can greatly reduce the infectivity of common pathogens, said Lindsay Myers, who worked for BioFire for 19 years and created its online charts before leaving the company this summer. Whereas, with a pandemic pathogen, when everyone is susceptible, you need much stricter social distancing to contain. Epidemiologists use the term non-pharmaceutical interventions to describe the range of behavior changes, such as social distancing, that people use to lower their risk of infection. In a paper published in the December 1st issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Grenfell and colleagues noted that such behavior changes during the 1918 flu pandemic may have lowered the transmission of measles by 38%. But the focus of the paper was on the likely outcome in 2021 and beyond, after the coronavirus pandemic dissipates and such practices are relaxed. Using mathematical models, they focused on the likely effect of respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, a common and very contagious virus that infects most children before their second birthday and causes over 200,000 hospitalizations and 14,000 deaths in normal years. The bottom line is, while we have these controls in place, there is a slow buildup of susceptibility to these other viruses, said Rachel Baker, a postdoctoral researcher in Grenfell's department and first author of the paper. The numbers of infections were pretty stable for 30 years, but in 2020 it disappeared. We need to be aware that future large outbreaks may be coming. Social distancing is probably not the only factor suppressing endemic pathogens. Walgreens, for instance, has seen unprecedented demand for flu vaccine shots this season, according to Kevin Vann, chief medical officer of the pharmacy chain. Vaccines, unfortunately, are not available for most other viruses. But another powerful factor, called viral interference, could also play an important role in limiting infections. In a paper published October 1st in The Lancet Microbe, Ellen Foxman of Yale University reported that a prior rhinovirus infection greatly reduces the chance of contracting influenza A. The reason, she found, is that infection with one virus prompts the body's immune system to release interferon, which blocks replication of all viruses. The interferon response is one of the body's best defenses against respiratory viruses, Foxman said. As soon as it gets turned on by one virus, any other virus that comes along and tries to grow in the respiratory tract can't. The body's response to SARS-CoV-2, in other words, could be blocking the spread of other viruses. Its response to other pathogens might produce similar protection. Foxman points to temporary breaks in the spread of influenza during the 1918 pandemic, as well as during the 2009 H1N1 swine flu pandemic, as possibly due to viral interference from rhinovirus. Viral interference could also help explain a deep mystery about the coronavirus, why so few children are getting severely sick from it. As it happens, one of the only endemic viruses still circulating widely now is rhinovirus, which typically causes the common cold. And according to Myers, rhinovirus is circulating only in pediatric populations. It's been wiped out in adults. To be clear, no one is suggesting that people should intentionally infect themselves with rhinovirus to protect themselves from SARS-CoV-2. I do not advocate people going out infecting themselves with anything, Foxman said flatly. But when the pandemic is finally brought under control by the vaccines now being rolled out, will it be safe for most people to toss their face masks and return to normal life? It's a real possibility that we're going to see increased outbreaks of the endemic infections, said Ben Lopman, an epidemiologist in Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. If people haven't gotten infected this year because of actions taken to prevent COVID-19, there's a real risk of bigger outbreaks when we go back to normal. Besides larger than normal numbers of endemic infections, Lopman added, some of those infections could be more severe than normal, again because of waning immunity. Even so, he emphasized, it's certainly a good thing that we're keeping these other infections in check right now when our hospitals are filled with COVID-19 patients. But we're learning that the effects of the pandemic are complex. They're going to be long-lasting, and we're going to find that they extend beyond just the disease that SARS-CoV-2 causes. Of course, predicting the future effect of a once-in-a-century pandemic is an uncertain business. This is something that hasn't happened in our lifetime, said Messiker, the Colorado pediatrician. We know there will be more children and adults susceptible to enterovirus D68, influenza, parainfluenza, RSV. But what will really happen in reality, we don't know. Foxman expressed similar reluctance to take a firm prediction. The decline in respiratory viruses has been really fascinating, she said. It's incredible. We've never had a natural experiment like this before. What the consequence will be for the short and long term remains to be seen. Only one thing is a certainty, she added. Eventually, these viruses will come back. They always find a way. And now today, I'm going to end on a more upbeat note. This is an article titled Reasons to be Cheerful. Vaccines expert explains why he thinks U.S. can stop the spread of the virus by June, from CNN's Naomi Thomas. Even as the United States broke a record for the number of COVID-19 deaths reported in a single day, Dr. Paul Offit told CNN's New Day there were several reasons to be hopeful that the coronavirus situation could get dramatically better soon. Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia and a member of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, acknowledged the awful numbers are likely to continue for a few months, but said there are reasons for optimism. Mass vaccinations. There are two remarkably effective vaccines, and we're finally starting to get how to mass administer, Offit said, citing examples such as the Pennsylvania Convention Center or the Dodger Stadium. Meanwhile, two more vaccines, those from Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, are right around the corner, he added. Warmer weather. The weather will get warmer. When the weather gets warmer, that makes it much more difficult for this virus, Offit said, explaining that when it is hot and humid, the virus, which is spread by small droplets, spreads less easily. New political administration. Offit said the incoming Biden administration isn't into this cult of denialism that surrounded the Trump administration's coronavirus response, and it would take this problem head on. A population building immunity. The number of people who have been reported to have been infected with the coronavirus, 23 million, is an underestimate, according to Offit. Many people have had an asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic infection and were never tested. The numbers who have been infected are probably closer to 65 or 70 million, he said. That's 20% of the population that, when they're re-exposed to this virus, are not going to become sick with it, he said, although it's not clear how long immunity lasts after infection. If another 55 to 60% of the population can be vaccinated, something which Offit said can be done at 1 million to 1.5 million doses a day, then I really do think that by June, we can stop the spread of this virus. And on that optimistic note, we're going to wrap up your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, January 13th, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and here's what's coming up. Next, it's the program Eyes on Success, which will take us to 2 o'clock, and then we'll bring you USA Today with the national news. At 3 o'clock, we have local news, and here are some of the articles that we'll be reading at that time. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, coronavirus, officials work on mass vaccine distribution plan for Midland. City Council, city will provide hotel rooms for homeless who contract COVID. Oil, Pioneer completes $4.5 billion acquisition of Parsley. From the Odessa American, Odessans left in the dark on COVID rates. County official says vaccines, not numbers, are the top priority. County's 2021 road work detailed. West 42nd widening to be extended. Those and other stories are coming up at 3 o'clock. And at 6 o'clock tonight, we'll bring you more news with the Wall Street Journal. As always, Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Be safe and have a great day.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 54 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program covering a wide variety of topics of interest to people with vision loss. I'm Nancy Goodman-Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy. So I'm curious, how did you get into this field?
Oh, wow. How much time do we have? Well, I'll try and give it the abridged version, Peter.
And that was the question I asked after we were completely done interviewing our guest. And it led to such an interesting conversation that we figured we would make this show out of it.
That was David Bradburn, currently Vice President of Global Sales at HumanWear, and he has been involved in the access technology field for over 35 years. A lot has changed over that time, and today you get to pretty much listen in on a conversation between David as a salesman and Pete as a user as they reminisce about the evolution of access technology equipment since the earliest days. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from David Bradburn.
Okay, so my tip is this. I would encourage everyone to keep an open mind and be receptive to new technologies. If you're anything like me and you've been doing this for a long time, probably you have a couple of favorites, things that you might have even owned for years. But just know that there are constantly changing products coming from companies within this industry and indeed everything that we think of as technology. So keep an open mind, check things out. Even though many of the conferences have gone virtual for the year ahead, that's actually good news for all of us because you don't have to travel very far to learn about these things.
And as we walk through some of the changes that have happened in access technology over the past few decades, we'll see exactly why that is true.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
Let's start by meeting David and learning about the company he's with now, HumanWear.
Well, hi, my name is David Bradburn. I am located near Boston, Massachusetts, and that's where I'm speaking to you from now.
We talked with you a couple of months ago about some specific products, but this week we're going to talk about the history of technology and how it's changed through the years, and it's kind of a fun journey. But in the meantime, you have a new position. Can you tell us about what you're doing these days?
I'd love to. Thanks, Peter, and it's nice to be back talking to you. Actually, a little over a month ago, I joined a company named HumanWear. It's possible that some of your listeners have heard of that company before.
I think so.
Yeah, they've been around for actually 32 years. They're a Canadian-based company, though they do have offices throughout the world, including the USA, and I am working with their sales team. I'm their Vice President of Global Sales. So that's where I am now. Very happy to be there. And just as a quick intro, for those that haven't heard of HumanWear, I guess it's possible there might be one or two people. HumanWear is a manufacturer of assistive technology for people who are blind or visually impaired. So they offer both braille solutions, they also have talking solutions, and they also have large print.
Eyes on Success is made possible in part by our corporate partners. Underwriting pairs the impact of targeted marketing with the integrity of community goodwill.
Learn more by sending an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is the evolution of access technology as it parallels both David's career and Pete's experiences as a user.
So I'm curious, how did you get into this field?
Wow, how much time do we have? Well, I'll try and give it the abridged version, Peter. So I am from England originally, and in 1984, I began working for the company that was at that time the distributor for something called the Kurzweil reading machine. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I remember it well.
Okay. So I go back to the days when that Kurzweil reading machine, as impressive as it was, and really there was nothing else like it in the world at the time,
yes,
was the size of a fridge, the type that you send your kids off to college with, but except it weighed about 300 pounds, and so it wasn't that portable.
And it cost $30,000.
It did. It did cost $30,000. And it's amazing today to think that we actually had places that were buying those things. It was mostly libraries back then.
Yes. Well, you talked about those early Kurzweil machines. So we're actually retired physicists. We both have PhDs in physics. And when we were working at Xerox, Xerox had just bought the Kurzweil company.
Yeah.
And they were looking to, I would guess, to get the number of manufactured units up and the price down. They were giving away some of those reading machines, and I wound up with one in my office, and I figured, oh, this would be neat. I'll try to read the Xerox internal memos and stuff like that, and they were just terrible. First of all, you know, the little scare would go back and forth. It would take like 2 minutes to go through the page, and it would get half of it wrong.
Right.
But, you know, still, it was a great invention. I tried, you know, reading other things, and it just wasn't that reliable. And now when you think of that same technology on your phone, just snap a picture, and it's automatic.
Yeah, the KNFB reader is, you know, exhibit number one, right? I mean, it's it is. It's incredible. You know, thinking back to those XIS days, so actually, when I say Kurzweil, when I first came to the U.S., actually, it was Xerox Imaging Systems that hired me.
Oh, okay.
I worked with them for about 6 months, and I was inches away from getting my work visa when I was approached by Michael Sokol, who used to work for Xerox Imaging Systems. He was the director of sales there.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to me, he had gone off and with Raymond Kurzweil and some other guys that he knew, they had formed Kurzweil Educational Systems, which made the Kurzweil 1000 software.
Oh, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they asked me to join them. And so I did, but, you know, at great expense because it meant that my work visa application was null and void and I had to start all over again.
Oh, jeez.
That was a tumultuous year in my life. But anyway, I'm glad I made the decision I did because Kurzweil was a really good experience for me.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That was quite innovative products at the time. And,
indeed.
Amazing how it all changed.
It is.
Wow. So you got into the access technology field a really long time ago.
So I started in the industry at that time, and that same company was also a distributor for other companies that many people have heard of. So back then it was Henter Joyce. This is long before they became part of Vispero.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew Ted Henter personally. So we represented them. We represented Zoom Text. We represented Index with their range of Braille embossers.
Yep.
We also represented Enabling Technologies at that time.
Do you ever have the opportunity to use any of this access technology?
In fact, it was during my time in England, I spent about 10 years in the industry there, where I learned Braille. Once upon a time, when I was working with Braille a lot, I used to be able to type and read even grade 2 Braille fairly proficiently. Now, I can certainly do some grade 2, but I'm not as proficient because I don't work with Braille so much anymore. But that's what I did. As a personal aside, my wife is Mexican, mm-hmm. and so we were married and living in England, and it was after about 4 or 5 years living there, we decided we'd give Mexico a go. We emigrated to Mexico, took our young daughter at the time with us, and I worked with Pulse Data in New Zealand, which would subsequently become Humanware.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. Yep.
And I was working with that company and distributing their products as well as Kurzweil and some other things throughout Mexico and Latin America. And in 1996 was when I was approached by the folks at Kurzweil asking if I would join them as their international sales manager. And so that happened, and it was because of Kurzweil back then that I got my U.S. work visa and subsequent green card, and I became a citizen after that. But nevertheless, I worked in the U.S. since 1996. We've been in Massachusetts all this time. I was with Kurzweil until 2012.
And what came next?
And then after Kurzweil, I was with Baum, with their Braille displays and CCTVs. I was working with Baum until the very end of 2017, and their company, unfortunately, that was a very sad day, went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
But we had been distributing for Zoomax during this time. And so as Baum was about to close, Zoomax said, hang on a second, we're actually thinking of starting our own company. You want to join us? And I was like, sure, that'd be great.
Oh, geez.
So I literally kind of, you know, ended my job with Baum on one day, and the next day I was working with Zoomax, so I never missed a beat.
Wow. Oh, you've certainly been in this industry for a long time with some really varied and interesting experiences.
Yeah.
And it was in this role working at Zoomax that we interviewed David this past summer about their AceSight series of products. But as we learned in the introduction, he has recently switched to working for Humanware.
You know, it's funny. I don't often get to speak to people and reminisce about such things. But when I think back to, you know, some of the early products that we used to sell, mm-hmm. I mean, even my experience just thinking back to computers, we were also dealing with Kurzweil speech recognition back then. And I was showing speech recognition back before people even considered it as something that someone who was a quadriplegic mm-hmm. could use to command and control a computer. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah.
And now, of course, you know, we all have speech recognition with Siri and Alexa and these other kind of smart speakers at home. And it's just all commonplace stuff, and it works with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, I can remember it used to take me a whole day to train and set up a voice profile with the speech recognition, and then wait for another 24 hours while the computer churned. And if you got a power cut in between all that, the computer turned off, you have to go back to square one and start again.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I actually used Dragon Naturally Speaking about 20 years ago
yeah.
for maybe a year or two until I finally caved and had surgery on the carpal tunnel. But it was like you described, you know, the training was hours and hours and hours, and the result
yeah.
wasn't so good. And now you can just talk into your smartphone, and it gets it almost all right.
Exactly.
In fact, a few sentences into my initial attempt to use Dragon Natural Speaking after the seemingly endless training, I said, I feel like an idiot. Because really, at the time, nobody was used to talking to a computer back then. And it parroted back, I feel like a Canadian.
You know, I have the Apple CarPlay feature in my car, in my Jetta. So I am always impressed that I can be driving along with, I don't take my eyes off the road, and I'll get a text message or a message from my wife or one of my dealers or something, and I'm giving fairly elaborate responses. I would say I speak for a minute.
Yes.
And all of a sudden she comes back and there's scarcely an error anywhere.
Yeah. It's incredible.
And what errors there are don't affect the contextual understanding of what I've said, so I don't even worry about it.
Right.
Just
right.
send it. And it works great.
Yeah, right.
No, it really is. It's been fantastic to see where it's come from.
Boy, it has come so far in 20 years.
You know, when I started in the industry, of course, I was a very young man. I'm still young now, I might add, but I'm 53.
Yeah.
And here I am. I'm fast becoming one of the elder statesmen, I suppose, because, again, most of the people that I knew and worked with in the early days have retired.
So if you want to have some fun, we got it into our heads, wouldn't it be cool to get Dean Blasey, Jim Fruchterman, and Ted Henter on a Skype call together.
Yeah.
And we interviewed them about, you know, Freedom Scientific, how it formed, and what they've been doing since. And that
yeah.
wound up being two consecutive episodes.
Oh, so you're telling me you did do it?
Oh, we did.
We did. Oh, we did a few years
ago. We did.
Was there an episode number in terms of that podcast?
Yes, 1740 and 1741.
Wow, interesting.
The funny thing was, we had previously interviewed each of them separately for other episodes. We've actually had Ted Henter on several times. And we decided, well, you know, maybe we can get these guys together. But they hadn't really kept in contact with each other. So it was like this big get-together party for these guys. I think Ted and Dean did a little bit, but not much.
Yeah.
Well, so, I think Ted and Dean are actually friends.
Yeah, but they don't see each
but
other
But Jim
much.
Was a business relationship with the other two. And, oh, my gosh, the banter.
It was really kind of fun.
It was so fun.
That was excellent.
I'm Dean Blasey.
I'm Jim Fruchterman.
I'm Ted Henter.
We were a core part of growing the assistive technology business into having widespread impact on the community of people who are blind. We were there for sort of the golden age.
Yeah.
And if you want to hear that episode, we'll have a link to that in our show notes associated with this episode.
So that clip obviously came from those episodes, but we also saved a recording of some of the banter back and forth before we buckled down to do a serious interview.
How you doing? I've been following you on Twitter.
Yeah, thank you. Doing pretty well.
Our big issue is whether or not Bookshare continues to be funded, and we're waiting to hear. because it's the once every 5 years. Yeah. But the good news is Republicans love us, Democrats love us. The president recommended an increase for our line item, which not a lot of education areas got a recommended increase from the Trump administration. But is that Ted?
Indeed. Hi, Ted.
Ted's here.
All right. Wow. Man, we should be in the same place and having a drink, but instead we're just talking.
Yeah. Now, what's this about?
Yeah.
You set this up, Ted.
Yeah.
No drink.
Yeah. When have we ever been together and not been having a drink, I wonder?
I know. This is the first.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's always later in the day, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to open a bottle of wine right now. It's 4 o'clock. It's happy hour here.
No, it's 2 o'clock here.
I have a question for you guys. When was the last time you guys actually got together in one group?
Oh, an NFB convention in Kentucky, probably?
Wow.
And how long ago was that?
10 years.
Wow.
10 or more, because I haven't been to a convention since about 2004, 3 or 4.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting get-together for you guys, too.
Yeah, yeah, it really is.
Neat.
I saw Dean recently back in April, but I haven't seen Jim in at least 12, 13 years.
That was a fun episode.
So back to our conversation with David.
Again, as I think about, you know, the things that have changed, there are also things that, you know, in some respects don't feel that different. So if you think about something like JAWS, I mean, I worked with JAWS when it was an MS-DOS screen reader, right? So, you know, long before we were getting into even Windows 3.1, much less Windows that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I think of the things that people were doing, I mean, the tasks that someone who was blind or visually impaired in an office environment compared to what people can do today, I mean, now nothing surprises me in terms of someone coming along and saying, well, this person's blind and they're fill in the blank with whatever their profession is.
Yes.
I don't think there's anything I haven't heard. I mean, literally, you can find an example of someone who's blind or visually impaired in every walk of life. And I think, you know, I've spoken at the NFB National Convention a couple of times in my life, and the last time I did so was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And that was when I was still with Baum. And I remember that I was about to address the General Assembly, but before I did, they had a guy come out. He's blind. On a bright red motorcycle, he rides in. Actually, he's kind of wheeling it along with pushing his feet along on the floor, so he wasn't like driving it. But nevertheless, he does it. You know, he's revving up and down, making all the engine noises as it comes in. And he parks this thing right in front of the dais where everyone is seated and standing. Turns off the bike, gets off the bike, proceeds to extract a white cane the way I remember seeing cowboys take a Winchester rifle off of the horse saddle. You know, kind of thing. It was like somehow, I mean, it was the length of the bike. The bike was really long. And he gets up, he comes up and talks, and apparently this guy used to be a semi-professional race car driver, was involved in a race-related accident, lost his sight immediately, and that was like 5 years before this event. And then what does he decide to do? He decides to become a motorcycle rider, and he was in the, at least at that time, he had the world record for being the fastest blind person on two wheels, and he had ridden this motorcycle at 100 miles an hour in the Bonneville Salt Flats.
We did an episode with
him. We interviewed him, yes.
Oh, did you? Fantastic. Oh, yeah. So you know the story.
Yeah. Yeah, and because the theory is, it's like, if this guy can figure out how to do whatever it is your dream is,
yes,
and if that's racing a motorcycle, go for it, you know, then maybe you can figure it out too, and nothing's impossible.
That's my point. I've been doing this for so long. So again, nothing really kind of impresses me. And I don't say that to be kind of, you know, flippant or anything. I have the same expectations for friends who are blind as I would anybody else. I just don't look at it as being, well, they're never going to get beyond some menial thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
So, well, I, of course it is. And so when we think about the young people, you know, and so of course at the NFB meetings, you know, one of the things they do during the banquet as well is they announce the scholarship winners. And you have all these young people that are, you know, they're the next generation of leaders, ultimately, certainly for NFB, but frankly for society at large. It warms the heart when you can see how, you know, once upon a time we had all this technology and we had to make so many compromises with them, whether it was inaccurate OCR results or something that was just slow and really, really expensive. And now we've got things like KNFB Reader that is really putting things into, you know, the mainstream. There's really no excuse for anyone to say that they can't access, well, no reasonable excuse, that they can't access print in this day and age.
Yes.
It shouldn't be a barrier any longer.
And that's kind of our motivation for doing this show. I mean, we've been retired now a long time, and it's sort of our retirement project, you know, our way of giving back. And just to show that, you know, we interview blind folks in various professions, be it oceanographer, lawyer, scientist, etc., and then people doing amazing athletic things like riding a bike, as you described, or running marathons, and, you know, just to show that just because you're blind doesn't mean you have to be on the corner selling pencils. You can be doing anything you want. We have the tools and the technologies these days. All you need is the motivation and a little drive.
Yep, I agree.
And it's been fun just connecting with people around the world in various situations just to see how they don't see these things as barriers and they just overcome these challenges.
Right. Yeah, it's good stuff, isn't it?
Your career isn't over yet, but it's been lengthy and varied. Is there any kind of summary comment that you'd like to make about what you've observed over the years in the evolution of access technology?
Wow, that's a big question. You know, when I think back to my very, very early days back in 1984 when I was working with the Kurzweil reading machine for the blind, when you consider that that device was big, heavy, expensive, now consider the KNFB reader app, right, which you can get for your phone. And I believe if you're buying it, it's like $75, and I think it's even free in some instances to certain people. That's what's happened in the span of 35 years. And since I mentioned Kurzweil, worth pointing out, Ray Kurzweil always told everybody we'd get there. And it was impossible to envision for the normal people like me that we could ever see something as small and portable. We speak about technology, it's advancing at a rapid rate. So if you consider what is brand new technology today, 18 months from now, the equivalent product is going to be smaller. How much smaller, I don't know. It's going to be faster. It's usually going to be cheaper. It's certainly going to be more efficient. And that applies to everything that's out there. If you think about assistive technology, and I mean, I've mentioned a couple of the Braille display products from Humanware. Someone sent me a photograph last week. It was a picture of him sitting at a Braille computer called the David. No relation. So the David is, or was, a bright red Braille computer. It was made by Baum years and years ago. This is going back to the very early 1990s. It was a 40-cell display. It was a 386 processor running MS-DOS, because back then that's what we were all using. It was a beautiful thing, I mean, at the time. I mean, who had ever thought of a computer for a blind person? And yet here was this thing, and we thought it was the be-all, end-all of Braille. And now, again, we've got these small little Braille displays now which have Bluetooth, and we can use that with an iPhone or an Android phone, and that phone has got more power than probably every computer that was in the room at the time. And that's just a Braille display. We could have the same discussion about magnification devices. Magnification devices, if we go back to the 1970s, were these huge TV-based things with a camera on a stand next to them. Once you set those things up, you weren't likely to move them because you can get a magnification app if you think about, you know, some of the stuff that's available on the phones, or even just the handheld magnifiers where these things will fit in your pocket. So, you know, when I think back to the tip of the week that I was sharing earlier, and, you know, encouraging people to kind of keep this open mind, it's the fact that certainly if something's working for you and it's reliably working for you and you're happy with it, don't rock the boat. I'm not encouraging people to try and fix something that isn't broken. But if you are in the market for something that's new, you're likely to be in a shock if you haven't been out shopping for 5 years because things have improved that much.
It's hard to believe how far we've come since those early days, almost unimaginable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is totally unimaginable. It's a very exciting time to be alive when you think of technology.
This was great talking with you. It's kind of fun.
Oh, sure. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, of course. It's my pleasure.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about Humanware and how to contact David Bradburn directly.
If people want to find out more about HumanWare and some of the products that they sell for low vision and blindness individuals, where would they go?
That's really easy to answer. So the web address, of course, is always the easiest way. The website is the usual www. And then HumanWare. So HumanWare.com, HumanWare.com. There's also a toll-free phone number that you can call. That's 800-722-3393. I'll repeat that. It's 800-722-3393. And